Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act. An act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics. Chris, we need to talk about surveillance.
Yeah, let's do it.
Ray, you can also participate if you want in the conversation. It's fine.
That would be fantastic. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah. I'm here for Chris, that's for sure.
So we have on the show today Dr. Chris Gilliard, who is, well, a man of many words that he has written, and I should just shut up and let him tell you who he is.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I am the co-director of the Critical Internet Studies Institute. And I am working on a book called Luxury Surveillance that'll be out in the fall of 2026.
Yeah, it's fantastic to have you on. So thanks so much for agreeing. And we're really looking forward to this conversation. I think the surveillance angle is such an interesting one when we're talking about AI. There's kind of a rich history in science fiction of AI surveillance, right? Skynet and all of this stuff. But in the real world, it feels like it's slipped under the radar a little bit, at least in the context of chatbots and all of this. So I would really just like to kind of get your thoughts on how you're seeing surveillance play out in the new world of generative AI.
There's two ways that come to mind almost immediately. One is with the training data for these large language models, and that mostly they're made up of large amounts of text that has been scraped and ingested without people's consent. I want to reference the particular study that just came out. I don't remember who did it, but that you're talking about the extent to which there are people's passport information, their resumes with their address, you know, all kinds of things that we would consider really personal information that's in a lot of these models. Could talk more about that, but that's just like a real quick summary. But the other thing I think about is the buzzword now of agentic AI that a lot of these people are talking about. And I think about Meredith Whitaker from Signal, who I think pointed this out really well. Now, the claim is that at some point we'll be able to employ AI agents to go out and do things for us, whether that's shop for us or, you know, plan a vacation and book hotels, call restaurants, whatever the case may be. But as Meredith pointed out, that if we ever get to the point that these things actually work, the level of surveillance that will be required, the kinds of access that that system would need to essentially be your concierge or your any kind of real assistant would be, I mean, the way I've put it, it is that it would make the current level of data that's sucked up by Google and Facebook, it would make these companies blush. That it's so expensive, right? That it's sort of mind-boggling. And I think that's the point. But I think that those sort of two ends are the things about, you know, AI and surveillance that are kind of most front of mind for me right now.
The thing is, though, Chris, I mean, I know you've talked about this in other places, in your articles and stuff, but there's a pernicious sort of introduction of surveillance, isn't there? I think this is the thing which is true of a lot of technology in general, you know, that it's very sort of like gradually introduced into our lives for seemingly beneficial situations. You know, these things are claimed to be good for us. I mean, obviously, who doesn't want an assistant, for example? You know, just in general, it would be nice, you know. But like you say, it's a disgusting amount of surveillance required.
Yeah.
But in these other situations with like doorbells and sports trackers and just even email, Yeah, but I mean, I remember when Gmail came out and this idea that all of your emails would be read by Google for searching.
Yeah.
Was, no, and you know, and now I think Gmail is either number one or one or two between Microsoft Outlook and Gmail, you know. So people, what do you think about like people's ability to determine how this surveillance works? How do you think that's perceived?
Yeah. So I have, since I've been working on the book and with the advent of a lot of the popularity of chatbots, you know, I think there's been some really interesting developments. And so one of them to me is that companies, there used to be sort of the claim that we exchange, you know, free in quotation marks, technology for some bit of surveillance and convenience.
You are the product. Yeah.
You know, that was always sort of the claim with Facebook, Google as well, that, well, the reason these products are free is, you know, you exchange like a little bit of information about yourself. And in return, you get better search results or you get relevant ads and things like that.
Hmm.
But the interesting thing is they were always pretty coy about, or, you know, in some cases, they outright lied about the extent to which they were surveilling you. Then, you know, over the years, we find out, you know, Google's driving by your house and they're targeting people in all kinds of ways, you know, based on, say, trauma or misery that they experienced. You know, there's Facebook pixels on the website that you use to make a therapy appointment, you know, on and on and on and on. So that articulated bargain was not what it seemed to be.
Yeah.
Okay, that there was always more to it. And companies either misled people or, again, in some cases, outright lied about it.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing to me is that this sort of bargain now is changing. And instead of saying, well, we'll surveil you a little bit and in exchange, you'll get X, Y, and Z. Now they're saying, well, we'll surveil you all the time.
Mm.
You know, so like that's the pitch with a lot of chatbot companions.
Yeah.
With the wearables now that have some sort of AI in them.
Right.
You know, with the glasses that go on your face. I mean, glasses go on your face, right? With the glasses, with the pendants, with, you know, with stuff, with rings, you know, that go on your finger, not ring doorbells. That now the articulated bargain is different.
Mm.
Now it's, or, you know, AI agents. Now it's, we'll watch you all the time.
Yeah.
And this is going to be good for you in this manner of way. Now, I don't think that's a good bargain.
No.
I mean, I don't think it was ever a good bargain. But I think to kind of directly address your question, Ray, like, I don't think they were ever honest about what the bargain was.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. I feel that too.
There was like a kernel of truth in that. But also, you know, what they didn't mention is all the predatory ways that would be used, all the people they'd loan it to or sell it to, the ways it would be used by governments, on and on and on. And so now I think, you know, I mean, I think now kind of all they have left to sell is surveillance. And so now they have to, you know, these companies have now got to be more explicit in trying to sell you that thing as a benefit.
Well, yeah, that's wild. I mean, this stuff on luxury surveillance, I think it really, it hit home with me because, I mean, I, like I said, that I am wearing a Fitbit and I am ashamed of that fact. But Ray and I have talked about this a little bit before. It's like, okay, I am ashamed to be wearing a Fitbit, but actually I'm not wrong to want health metrics on myself. Like, that's not a thing that I should be ashamed of wanting. But the problem is, like you say, I've, you know, made this devil's bargain. And, you know, at the beginning of it, it's very easy. Even, you know, I'm a computer programmer. I work in this world. I've even unfortunately worked for an ad tech company a long time ago. I also worked for Amazon. So I'm a really evil person. But anyway.
You've done a walk of shame.
I know.
It's all coming out now. Chris is about to hang up.
He'd be right to do so, yeah. But it's so easy at the beginning to just overlook this and think it's for you, you know. And I love your idea of luxury surveillance that, like, not only is it for you, but also it's a trendy thing. You're flashing the Fitbit. You've got the rose gold one or whatever. And actually, you just reminded me, Ray, when you were talking about Gmail, in the beginning, it was this limited edition thing where they sent invites and then you would earn invites and you would invite your friends. Because I remember how cool I felt when I sent out 5 invites to Gmail. And now I feel like, you know, that, like you said in that one podcast, Chris, with Paris, you said, don't give the gift of surveillance for Christmas. And that's just what I did. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh, Lord. Yeah.
You know, I think one of the things about these devices, right, and the sort of bargain that we've struck is that we've also been told that we can't have these things without the surveillance.
Mm. Right.
You know, right. I mean, and so it's possible if, for instance, you think you need surveillance cameras, you know, on your property and things like that, it's possible to have them in a way that doesn't feed it to Amazon and to law enforcement and fusion centers. You know, it's possible to have a device that tracks your health metrics and, you know, doesn't send it to these companies who and send it to God knows where else.
Yeah.
But again, a lot of people who use these, and I don't want to sort of victim blame or anything like that, but there's been a very successful decades-long campaign to say, like, hey, if you want these things and you want them to be affordable at all, or you want them to work, then it has to also come with your information going out into a variety of different parties. That's also not true. I mean, you two know that better than I do. That's also not true, but it's been a very successful campaign to make people believe that that's true.
Yeah, I was just going to add there that I'm a cyclist, and I use also like watches to track routes and heart rate and all this kind of stuff. And I bought this watch probably 10 years ago, Suunto, and it had a software on a local computer. And it was great. You know, you could just plug your watch in and it would read it. It would put it on a computer. You'd get some nice metrics about your route, and, you know, all the kind of like speed and stuff like this. And it was really great, you know, lovely stuff. But then I think they basically, well, I know they basically said, oh, now we're stopping this local software and we're going to put it on the cloud. And it's really good for you because, you know, now you can share it with your friends. You can put it with Strava and all these other sort of like mixed sort of systems. Mm-hmm. So I stopped using it. I used the watch still, but now I just don't connect it to anything. I used the watch for my own heart rate, but it's now, you know, kind of like a lot less useful than it was. And it's difficult to buy watches these days that only operate.
Yeah.
Either even the watch on themselves, you know, locally. So the default, like you say, Chris, now is everything is on the cloud. Everything is kind of shareable and, you know, by you and your friends, but guess what? Also by us and our friends.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, just I'm struck. There was a recent story that came out about a high-ranking, was it Swedish official? Oh gosh, I wish I could remember the country. But that there was a security breach because his Strava routes were very easily tracked.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I think it was Sweden or Norway, yeah.
Right, and we've seen this over and over and over again. Yeah, in that, you know, I mean, there's different sort of threat models and security issues for, you know, high ranking politicians and things like that. But, you know, even on kind of smaller and individual levels, a lot of the times these are the lack of privacy with some of these things, I think is very dangerous for people.
Maybe we talk about that a bit, Chris, because I often have conversations with people like at conferences or other software developers who are like, well, you know, I've got my data up there and it is giving me the benefit and it's just me, you know, it's for me and I'm getting a benefit out of it.
Yeah.
And these people like Google or Strava or whoever, they have a little bit of extra data, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's just a tiny bit of data. They're just taking a little. But this is, you know, and I think this attitude is pervasive, you know?
Yeah. It's my least favorite argument, right? I think it comes out of a little bit of the nothing to hide idea.
Mm. Possibly, yeah.
But I think, too, that what it does, you know, we talked a little bit about this before, you know, earlier, kind of before we hit record. But I think there's a little bit of privilege there in that there are certain folks who think that they have, that there's no way in which information that's gathered about them will be marshaled against them.
Yes, yes, exactly.
They may or may not be right. But I mean, I think in an increasingly authoritarian time, we don't know whether or not that's going to continue to be true. But also there's an assumption embedded in that, and that is that the data is going to be accurate.
Right.
And that the thing that you're, you know, that the conclusions drawn from that data will be accurate.
I think the second part is really good. Yeah, really good point. Yeah.
There's no reason to believe those things are true.
Yeah.
And then a third thing is that it normalizes that kind of data collection for people who are more vulnerable.
Yes. Yeah.
And so if we think about people who may be pregnant or maybe seeking some type of reproductive care, you know, in a red state, for instance, that it's becoming normalized that people wear devices that, you know, track their cycles or, you know, claim to know when they may or may not be pregnant and things like that, that that's become normalized is a danger for people.
Right.
There's all different kinds of ways. I mean, you know, like there's tons of examples of sort of like geofence warrants being used to falsely accuse people of a crime based on being just being somewhere when a crime was committed. I mean, I could go on, right? But the belief that the data is accurate and is going to be used in a way that the conclusions that are drawn from it are not going to harm you, I think is a very questionable set of beliefs.
Wasn't there a story in America? I mean, this is like even 10 years ago, possibly, based upon like, what's the biggest store you have in America?
Walmart?
Walmart, yeah. Where Walmart sent some pregnancy care stuff to a family.
Oh, this was the Target story.
Oh, it's a Target story. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk about that, yeah, because I think that was a...
Yeah, so this is a Charles Duhigg essay. I forget where it appeared. And it may be apocryphal, right? So the story goes that Target had this intense level of tracking and algorithms that based on the products that people buy could accurately determine, you know, with some level of accuracy anyway.
Yeah.
I want to articulate. The story goes, right? Could accurately determine whether or not someone was pregnant before they even, and then that they would start sending those people things like, you know, coupons for diapers and formula and things like that. Target, as the story goes, sent out these mailers to a teenage girl who was pregnant, and the father showed up at Target, you know, angrily asking why she was getting these promotional materials. Now, I don't know if that's actually what happened. There's been some debate about like how accurate that story is or things like that. But I think whether or not that's exactly how it happened, there is an important point in there, which is that stores and data brokers and the government make all kinds of assumptions about us based on the data they collect and often act on that data, whether or not it's true. You know, or whether or not the assumptions drawn from it are true.
Yeah. And I think the point about that one is that to some extent it was like embarrassing for the young lady, you know, in this, like, let's say this apocryphal story, but, you know, it was a sort of embarrassment factor, which is, you know, it's enough. I think it's enough of a sort of trigger for people to think, this is not good. You know, I don't want my private data being leaked to my wife or something. I'll give you a small other example. And this is actually, I know this for a fact, is I worked for a car company for a long time. And we were releasing software to give people GPS software as part of their system. We had to add an option for the main driver to block the other driver from seeing where they'd been. Because it was called the girlfriend, the girlfriend option.
Oh my goodness.
So they didn't want their partner to see where they'd been.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, but the car company knew it. You know, so.
Yeah, I mean, and car companies make some wild claims. You know, Mozilla has done some research on this about what they think they can ascertain based on the data produced by a car. I mean, including up to and including whether or not you've had sex in the car.
I know. I mean, I drive, you know, a car. There's the with whole, that.
You know, the Uber God view story. I mean, there's so much. If you've ever dug into what data brokers do, also the way they monetize people's trauma. I mean, they have categories of, you know, people have cancer and people who've recently lost a child. I mean, these are categories you can use to help target people. Yeah. And so I think the sort of map of how data might be used to harm you with most people who aren't, you know, stuck in the, you know, swamps, like looking at this stuff is a little bit incomplete.
Yeah. I was thinking there, I mean, we've danced around this a little bit, but you know, I work with a data engineering team at work. So I know a lot of data engineers, and data quality is the thing they talk about day in, day out, you know, every minute of their day. That's the thing they're most worried about. And basically, the more data you have, the worse the aggregate quality is. And I think this is a huge problem. Like, we saw this a bit with the kind of Snowden revelations, that when you have that much surveillance and you have this enormous dragnet, you know, the problem becomes like, how do I find a needle in a haystack? And by the way, there might not even be a needle in the haystack. But then you're overfitting, right? So you're matching on patterns that are not there. And this, to me, as you were saying, Chris, like, the impact of this on marginalized communities is awful, because you already have these kind of predictive policing type things, right, that are suspecting, hey, there's a needle in that neighborhood over there, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm definitely going to find it. You know, that's what these systems do.
Yeah. And I think with AI, you know, in quotation marks, I think that there's a lot of assertions now by these companies that they can find this needle, right? Mm. I mean, this is what Palantir does. This is what Axon is getting into. I mean, all kinds of things. But I mean, I think one other point I wanted to get at from that is that we've seen law enforcement and other governmental institutions willing to act on this data.
Yes.
You know, again, whether or not with little regard for if it's accurate.
Yeah.
You know, if we think about the sort of deportation machine that's ramped up by this administration, you know, that a lot of the ways data is used, AI algorithms, however you want to frame it, is in support of policies and actions that powerful institutions want to do anyway. Like, the data is sort of exists to justify those things. And so I think that's always a concern when we participate in ways that we don't have to, right? When we make ourselves more beings who are having our data extracted.
Yeah, it was just the word propaganda comes to mind here, right? And this idea of, as you said, there's this I've got nothing to hide idea. And I think we've been subjected to this idea that the police, law enforcement, the CIA, whoever, you know, whoever is on our side, they're using this data, and they might be breaking the law, but they're breaking the law for a good reason, because they're going to get a bad guy, right? And I've just been thinking about this, and I feel like Batman is the ultimate propaganda, right? You have this vigilante who's outside the law, but don't worry, it's always the bad guys. And, you know, Batman goes and gets the bad guys that the police can't for whatever reason. And they're always bad. It's interesting, in the Christopher Nolan film, you know, they even had this huge surveillance machine. What was it? Dark Knight Rises, maybe. And there's this whole scene at the end where Alfred is like, if you don't destroy this machine, you know, Master Bruce, I'm going to resign or whatever. And then, of course, like, Master Bruce does not destroy the machine, you know, spoiler alert. But it's somehow okay. And I don't know what it is about this that I find so infuriating, but propaganda, I don't like it.
Well, maybe the fact that Bruce is a billionaire, you know, in the telling.
Well, good point.
He's one of the oligarchs. He's one of the benighted souls, you know. And this is one of the sort of themes, I think, about, I think we were trying to get about trust, which is that AI is building upon this sort of trust that people have around computers. And like you said, Chris, there's a bunch of biases built in. We saw an episode recently in the UK where the British Post Office, I don't know if you're aware of this scandal, but the British Post Office was essentially built a system to help sub-postmasters do their accounts. But it was built on the presumption that sub-postmasters were, in fact, pilfering some amount of the money.
Right.
So that was their sort of going in position. And when it discovered that, in fact, yeah, there was some money missing, then it, again, confirmed all their biases. But it turned out, you know, over many, many years and even decades, and people killing themselves, going to jail, you know, these perfectly law-abiding people doing good for their community. You know, so this was not a marginalized community by any stretch. You know, this is my point. You know, you don't have to worry about the people that are oppressed. This is people that are like entrepreneurs, business people. That's how they were seen. That's how they saw themselves. And yet, because the software had some glitches in it, which the post office would not admit, those people were driven to, you know, driven out of their community, they're sent to jail. And like I say, one of them even committed suicide. And it's taken decades for them to have their reputations rehabilitated. So, I mean, I feel like the trust around computers was clearly misplaced, but now we're accelerating the degree to which we're trusting these technologies. And that to me is, I don't know how, given these post office scandals and these other scandals, how this amount of trust is being like upheld.
Yeah, I think one thing you were saying, Chris, like before we hit record was, you have to look at the Wizard of Oz, right? The man behind the curtain. So not only are we trusting the machines, but, you know, we're not looking at who is controlling the machines, who's building the machines.
Mm. Yeah, I think the case of Musk and Grok is a really important one when we're thinking about chatbots and large language models. Now, I'll say from the outset that it's very dangerous and something I would not recommend to ever take what he says at face value, right? I think it's important to note what he says, but I don't think we should take it at face value.
Completely agree.
Now, the reason I say that is when Musk talked about Grok coming out, he used some phrase about maximal truth-seeking, you know, chatbot. Now, again, I won't go down that rabbit hole, right? But what we've seen is that he is the sort of poster child. You know, I think this is more or less true for the other big models that we've seen. But in the case of Grok, it's very clear that there is some manipulation afoot, right? When the model doesn't perform in the way that he wants it to.
Right.
You know? And so, you know, whether that's the going off on the white genocide tangents, or, you know, the most recent episode where it was spitting out the admiration of Hitler.
Yeah, the Mecha, you know, Hitler
things
stuff.
Like that. Yeah. But I think what's important there is to note how manipulation works or might what it might look like. When we have someone who is very clearly, you know, whether it's him or someone else who works at the company or whatever, but it's very clearly being manipulated. That, you know, we are... I think that part of the work of AI, like as we're experiencing it now, at least in large language models and chatbots, is to consolidate power and to promote a particular voice as the authority, right?
Yeah.
You know, whether that's Claude or ChatGPT or Grok. And so the case of Grok, I think, can help us understand what's at stake here when we think about these things as producing truth. You know, I don't consider them a source of truth anyway, right?
Yeah.
But for people who do, I think that that's a very useful case to look at.
The thing about truth is it's a rather slippery concept, you know, and I think we should dive down rabbit hole a little bit, because that's one of the things that we were talking about in general, was that, you know, we used to agree on facts. And I think, you know, this concept of like saying, you know, what's 4,723 multiplied by 10,047,000? The answer is a fact. The answer is a number. And it's very hard to disagree with that number. But if you say, for instance, you know, how was the United States formed as a country? That's contentious.
Yeah.
You know, there can be certain historical moments that are recorded. But, you know, how exactly that's viewed is clearly... You know, and we've seen that in the last 10 years, in America itself. You know, it's a contentious aspect of reality itself is contended. So I'd like to dive into that a bit more detail, because I think this concept of truth through some synthetic model is, I mean, it's clearly bullshit, but yeah. How is it, again, trying to be sold as some fundamental place where we can eventually even,
yeah, you know,
even with artificial general intelligence, it's finally going to solve problems that we humans can't solve, you know? It's going to get to the truth.
Yeah. I mean, one of the really disappointing things is that I think part of the reason we've arrived here is simply so these companies can keep us on their website rather than going to another one.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, this is like a real, you know, like, it, you know, we've arrived at like a very problematic and fraught era because Google doesn't want you to go outside of Google. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, there are also larger sort of ideological and economic questions, but like, this is a big one.
Yeah. Yeah.
The problem, right? Like from their perspective is that it generates links and then you go somewhere else. I mean, and the way they solve that problem is to have this machine that they tell you gives you the answer, you know? I mean, we've seen the degradation of the information ecosystem. You know, I think Facebook has a lot to do with that.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, throughout the last, you know, couple of decades. But this is, I think, unfortunately, the next iteration that, you know, these companies now say, well, you don't have to go anywhere else to get the answer. Right. You can stay right here.
So they're basically, I mean, you know, we talked about them sort of like stealing people's work as inputs to the models. And then I think obviously Google have all kinds of supposedly like arrangements with news organizations to, you know, I think it's kind of a forced negotiation where these news organizations will allow them to take some snippets and eventually they should go to the actual newspaper or the channel, the fundamental source of this stuff. But increasingly that's not happening. Where is the point where the producers of this stuff are not going to cooperate?
I mean, I think it's a far worse, but it reminds me a lot of the pivot to video stuff with Facebook.
Oh, right. Mm. Yeah.
You know, but I don't think also that this can be removed from the fact that in terms of large scale news organizations, that most of them are owned by billionaires who are on board with the project of destroying journalism as we have known it. That, you know, whether that's Bezos with the Washington Post, the guy who owns the LA Times, who, you know, had the chat bot, you know, the both sides chat bot.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you know, this recent merger to be, I think, that Paramount or CBS is, you know, that consolidation and the destruction of journalism, I think they're part of the same project.
Yeah.
And so I think, Ray, like my part of that question, I think supposes that they're not on board with this, right? Like, but I'm not so sure that they're not, right? Like, you know, when you know, the Washington Post is bleeding subscriptions, you know, and I mean, there are still a lot of great journalists there.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are people who are abandoning it, you know, quality journalists and editors. They changed their, you know, editorial page to say that we're only going to talk about free market values and free speech and things like that. And so, I think it's part of, I sometimes don't like to say these things because it sounds conspiratorial, right?
I think seeing Bezos on a podium for Trump's inauguration it's not a stretch.
Yeah.
No, but I think that's a really interesting point because there is absolutely an aspect of class warfare here. It's just interesting. I'm kind of tying all these threads together in my mind as you say that. And really what we have is the AI companies want to define what the truth is, right? That's what's happening with the Google search result, the Google, what is it called? The AI summary thing at the top of the page. Mm-hmm. you know, just like you said, it's keeping people from leaving their website. Well, that's important for Google. Their first swing at this was making their search results worse. So you had to click through more pages of search results. But now they've come up with the Trump card, you know, here, we'll just tell you the truth in this little box and you don't have to go anywhere else.
Yeah. I mean, that came out. That's one of the things that came out in the Monopoly trial.
Yeah.
That they know that their search product is degraded right now and kind of don't care, you know, because they're what they want is to maintain eyes on a specific page.
Hmm. And I guess what they're thinking, well, clearly what they're thinking now is that, and it's something that OpenAI are claiming, is that ChatGPT is a better search engine, essentially.
Which is wild.
Yeah, but people in my sphere talk about that as well. You know, I was at a conference, like a work conference recently, and so many people were putting their hands up and they're saying they're using these GPT tools, these ChatGPTs, as a way of like finding about what they should do on holiday and like what restaurants they should go to and stuff like that. The kind of things that you would typically use a search engine for.
Yeah.
They're using the ChatGPTs for the chatbots now. I don't know if that's something that you are also like tracking with the surveillance stuff, Chris. You know, essentially it's just now, it's a battle for search, basically.
Yeah, and I think, you know, OpenAI just came out, and I don't know what this is going to look like yet, but they just came out with the announcement that they are now going to have, I don't even know what they're going to call it yet, but they're going to start incorporating advertising
right.
as part of their model with ChatGPT. And, you know, it gets me to asking, you know, at least with Google in the past, you know, it would say something like, you know, sponsored link or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But when we, you know, what is it going to look like?
Smaller and smaller text.
Right. Right. What is it going to look like when people are coming to these things for, you know, whatever it is, recommendations for travel, diet tips or whatever, you know, how do we determine whether or not that is the thing, you know, that, yeah, I mean, it, again, like even the way I was about to phrase it sort of presupposes that ChatGPT is like giving me like the right answer, right? Rather than some like statistical correlation. But, you know, when ads are introduced into that, like, what does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, that's the fun thing. Speaking of vacation planning, if I'm going to a small town in Nebraska and I ask it, tell me the best sushi restaurant in this city. There's no sushi restaurant in the city, but it's not going to tell me that, right? It will make up some, you know, Sakura on Northwest 13th Street is the best sushi restaurant in wherever in Nebraska. I mean, this is just how it works, like you said, because it's statistical correlation. It's a city, therefore it must have a sushi restaurant. Mm. We can't find any data on it, so let's just go with one called Sakura because a lot of sushi restaurants are called that, you know, like this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but if that chain or a chain similar to that have paid into the coffers of ChatGPT,
right.
then this is going to be the one that comes up as the most highly rated and all this kind of stuff because you're not – like in the past, you would look at a Google search page and it would say like there's Yelp reviews or there's the Google reviews or, you know, again, this like this concept of like providing some sort of objectivity around these results was kind of like, let's say at least, you know, there was a sort of an attempt to sort of make it look like there was some objectivity around these results. Whereas I think now it's just going to be like it has to just be assumed that it's objective. So there's no need to qualify it anymore. And that is also very dangerous because, and I feel like we're getting close to that where objective truth is just what comes out of these bots.
Yeah. And I mean, this is the thing, Josh, that you had pointed to that we sort of started talking about before we were recording is that, you know, some people may think this is hyperbolic, but I mean, I think some of the worst people in the world are the ones who run these companies. I think that, Ray, you mentioned, you know, who was lined up behind Trump during the inauguration.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that was a very clear signaling that they were in line with authoritarianism.
100%.
And that these same people are now saying, we've got this machine and we want it to be your therapist,
Jesus.
Your teacher, your coach, your best friend, your doctor, your travel agent. We should think about that a little bit.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is, so in kind of classic surveillance, classic AI systems, because what we used to mean by AI was not chatbots, right? Before they came along, we meant things like predictive policing systems or, you know, this fraud detection system, right, that you pointed to. But surveillance does look different with a chatbot. Like it's a little more pernicious, I think. And I'm just wondering, like, what are your thoughts on how surveillance is working there? And I'm also curious about, it's very obvious when you look at some of these kind of classic, you know, again, I'll go to predictive policing. It's very obvious to see how that disproportionately affects marginalized communities. But if we're looking at chatbots, what's going on there? I presume that once again, the most vulnerable are, you know, the softest targets there, but it's not clear to me exactly what ways that is.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of ways. I mean, I think there's two that stand out. I think first is the idea that it's going to be a study guide or a friend or a psychologist or psychiatrist, you know, a therapist. I do not think that despite all the things that these CEOs say, their kid's tutor and teacher is not going to be a chatbot. It's not. Right. That there are, I don't know if Sal Khan has kids. His kids, like, tutor is not going to be, you know, Conmigo.
Right.
Like, that it's just not going to be. Right. Like, you know, Sam Altman just had a kid. Like, the school he goes to is not going to be run by ChatGPT. Like, it's just not going to go like that.
Yeah.
That there's going to be a way in which these systems are understood as good enough for places.
Right.
That don't have proper funding,
right?
So that instead of, you know, smaller class sizes and enough teachers to go around, right, that they'll have these systems in place and say, well, this is, you know, yeah. I mean, we've started to see it with therapy that people say, well, there's, you know, affordable therapy is not available to a lot of people, but here's this chatbot,
right?
We've already seen this, and I think we'll see a lot more of that. I think the other way that I've been thinking about a lot is, you know, and we've been talking about this, right? That the degradation overall of the information sphere. You know, I used to do a lot of work in what I call digital redlining, right? The extent to which access information based on, you know, primarily on internet access, but also on algorithms, what that means to people who only have certain kinds of access, whether it's their Wi-Fi and the limits of that, their machines and the limits of that, the region where they're searching, all, you know, all the other signals that kind of help determine what kind of information you get. I think with chatbots, it threatens to supercharge those kinds of effects, right? You know, so we don't know, for instance, that, I mean, so there are schools and universities that are now getting their own chatbots or chat, you know, sort of chat, like University of Michigan, for instance, has it. And so I don't know the answer to this. Like, I have some ideas, but, like, will the University of Michigan and a chatbot at the local community college, are they going to be the same thing, right? Are they going to give the same kinds of information?
Right.
Are they, you know, so even in the case where both places are using them, is it going to give, like, the same kinds of information and things like that? Like, again, I have some theories. And so, but also I, my guess is that more and more that people who can afford it, whether that's, you know, Ivy League colleges or, you know, students in really high priced K through 12 institutions, things like that, are going to have much more kind of bespoke and personalized experiences that rely on human beings, and that the rest of us will not have that. I think that's what that's going to look like.
Well. Yeah, back to the kind of idea of luxury, right? So this is luxury powered by surveillance. You know, the only humans that are not machines are the our sons and daughters and children, you know, ours being the wealthy class.
But maybe also there'll be, I think you're hinting at that as well, Chris, is that there'll be kind of like quality aspects of the bots themselves.
I think so.
It will be like, you know, like gold star bots and, you know, sort of like standard bots. And you already see this kind of thing where, you know, I think OpenAI have different levels of of bots where, you know, you can pay a bit more for a better bot.
Right.
And so one can imagine
PhD grade. Whatever
bullshit they're using in their marketing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But the point is that I hadn't thought about that before, but you're right, is that I can see clearly now, actually, it becomes so obvious that what you're doing here is you're inviting some kind of like layering of the people into like affordability. So the people that have like, you know, you can have access to your bot, but that bot is going to be a fairly basic, it's going to be a basic bot. You can have a basic bot and then you're going to, yeah, each of the schools that you go to are going to have better and better bots. And eventually, like you say, they're going to have, you know, the real top tiers will have real human beings, and the human experience will be increasingly an elitist experience. God damn it! That's
dark.
But I can see that future coming pretty quick, actually.
Again, like I think it's very dangerous to take what they say at face value. And yeah. what I mean is like the CEOs of these companies. And
but they're not saying that, you
know? Right? But what they are saying is, well, you know, it can be your therapist, coach, you know, friend, all those things. And so, you know, that hype contains some important information, you know. A lot of times they're speaking to investors.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the problem is that other people hear this, right? That administrators at universities hear it.
Right.
You know, right. I don't think it can be overstated the degree to which a lot of why we see the adoption of these systems in places like universities is that administrators fear being sort of left out and left behind, you know, that they got to get in on it early. Because a lot of the things that these people claim these systems can do, I mean, in some cases they can't do them. In other cases, the utility or the degree to which they can do these things is wildly overstated.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
But, you know, that hype, I think, serves some very useful purposes.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm kind of wondering then, so the CEOs and so on, when they're speaking to the VCs, one of the things they're doing is trying to attract money, but also I think sending a signal to the market that like, hey, there's growth ahead for our company. We're still a growth company. Please don't price us as a real grown-up mature company, you know, with a P to E of like whatever, 1 to 5. Keep pricing us at 1 to 100. So it's pretty obvious to see why they would be selling VCs on total bullshit, right? And like you said, there's this degree to which other people are listening and, you know, believing it, or just out of sheer FOMO, you know, not wanting to be the last one in the race. But I also think Elon Musk has famously said that biological humans are just bootstrapping AGI, right? And so like there is a profoundly anti-human aspect of this as well. And I'm wondering if either of you have any thoughts on that.
Well, let me go back for a second, because I forgot something I think is really important to mention. When we're talking about the effects of these systems on marginalized people, that, you know, particularly in education, that these, because of how these systems are trained, they contain massive amounts of racism and misogyny and transphobia. And that, you know, this has already been shown in sort of like, for instance, the types of medical misinformation that these systems will put forward. The output is often different if people speak to it in, you know, AAVE and things like that, right? And that we are now...
What is AAVE, Chris?
African-American Vernacular English.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. That we are now putting these systems in schools, right? And also the way that they may exacerbate people, the sort of worst or most dangerous, I shouldn't say worst, but the most dangerous impulses of people who might have some sort of disability or, you know, be struggling with thoughts of self-harm and things like that.
Yeah.
And I mean, these are systems that are now being put in place in colleges, you know, and also in elementary schools with not enough guardrails. But to go to your, I mean, I say not enough guardrails. Like, I don't think they should be there in the first place, but.
No, exactly. Yeah.
But to go to your other question, I think that it's very important to note that many of these people who we've been talking about, right, who invest millions and billions of dollars, who run these companies, you know, and I don't say this lightly, like, I mean, I say this very intentionally, that they are cultists, you know, that their understanding of what they claim to be trying to build, right, beyond just the hype, some of the ways that they behave in this world, right? And, it, you know, I like, don't take my word for it. You know, read the Test Grill Bundle by Timnik Ebru and Emil Torres.
Yeah.
That they are, in all the ways that matter, cultists.
Yeah.
There's a religious aspect to how they think they are building these machines, whether that's sort of like the long-termism aspect, the pronatalist aspect, you know, that all of these things are tied together in ways I think that don't bode well for like the average person, right? Like when, you know, a favorite insult, for instance, of these people is to call folks NPCs, like non, you know, playable characters, that they don't think that most of us are actually real human beings, you know? And that their, you know, their stated goal, you know, is to birth some sort of like super intelligent beings that go out and populate and bring, you know, light to the universe.
Yeah.
I don't think it should be removed from our discussion of these things.
Yeah.
That some of the people most heavily invested in developing these technologies have profoundly anti-human ideologies that they are trying to enforce on the rest of us.
The thing that worries me about all that kind of stuff, because I look at it and I just feel like it's almost laughable on its face, the concepts that they're promoting. A lot of this Test Grill Bundle and the transhumanism and the whole concept of ASI, and it just feels like we're trying to create an alien that will destroy us. And this in itself, it feels bizarre that this idea would warrant a tremendous amount of investment, because it clearly feels like sci-fi. But I feel like they're using it to gain power and influence. I think it's quite venal. I don't think they're true believers or really interested in this set of philosophies at all. But I think they're vehicles for gaining influence and gaining power. And especially at the moment, it feels like they're trying to influence the current American regime with these feelings that the Americans need to dominate China, especially in artificial intelligence. We're getting a bit off the topic here, but I guess you've got something to say about that, Chris.
What I think is important is to understand the racist nature of this framing.
Yeah.
We've seen it for a long time. A point I like to illustrate, or an incident I like to point to, is whenever Zuckerberg was hauled before Congress.
Yeah, right.
And he would talk about, you know, well, you can't regulate us, or you shouldn't regulate us, you know, or Facebook and American tech companies need to succeed because we want American values versus Chinese values. Mm-hmm. It's pretty explicitly racist.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and also should be noted that this narrative came to be when Zuckerberg couldn't get Facebook into China. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like, let's not forget that he was the one that offered to let Z name his child. Right.
Yeah.
And so part of the story is, you know, and so I'm always curious about what we're supposed to take from this story, right?
Yeah, that
these companies say, because in some ways, the way I understand it is that they are trying to become more authoritarian than China.
Mm-hmm. Aren't they already?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, that's a very arguable point. But the root of that argument is racism. And I think what we've seen in the last couple months pretty explicitly is that this country has now become a full-throated advocate of exporting, once again, like white supremacy.
Yeah.
That a lot of the ways this administration has gone about saying, well, you can't not only, you know, are we not going to regulate companies, but we're going to try and say to other countries that they can't regulate our companies.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. JD Vance coming over to Europe. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, very dangerous game, but also I think pretty explicit in what those values are.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he spoke it out loud, you know.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, people aren't allowed to pray in their own homes. I mean, it's complete nonsense. It was like, just as a small aside, I remember before we kind of wrap up, is Naomi Klein. She said recently that the true hallucinations from AI are from its inventors and its corporate overlords. That feels like the same kind of thing here going on in government too. No, the hallucinations, they're kind of like explicit lies and misinformation, let's call it. They're hallucinations, deliberately misplaced information.
Yeah.
So now you can't tell the difference then between the hallucinations and reality anymore. And that seems to be part of this project as well.
Yeah.
This is a slight tangent. Maybe we cut this bit. I'm sorry. I kind of, but you know, I don't know if you've got a response to that, Chris, or if you just happy to just move on.
We have to understand, or I think interrogate, what is the work of AI, right?
Mm-hmm.
I got pretty salty earlier this week when I saw someone say, well, you know, the left doesn't have any answer to, you know, the critique of what happens when these systems get better? Like, what if AI actually works, right?
Right.
And, you know, like, I got a bunch of problems with this, but I think that a lot of people misunderstand what the actual work of these systems is. Is the overall goal? I mean, Josh, you and I, you know, you mentioned before, you know, Columbia's ChatGPT should not exist.
Yeah.
You know, I always reference a piece by Ali Al-Khatib defining AI, you know, and a piece by Rob Horning, you know, where he says that the purpose of generative AI is to enforce a worldview on people, you know, to force someone to see your particular worldview, right? He says that it's a tool of power that masquerades as a tool of knowledge.
I love that quote. I love
and
that
so,
quote. Yeah.
Yeah. That we have to understand what the actual work of these systems is if we're going to critique them, right? Like I talk about all the time, you know, I say all the time, like it sucks and it doesn't do this, it doesn't do that. And, you know, I think piercing that hype bubble is important.
Sure.
But also understanding like what is the job that these systems exist to do, right? And that is very important in sort of understanding what it looks like to resist them in any form.
Yeah. I know we have been going for quite a while, but I would love to leave on a, well, I think leaving on a hopeful note, that's not going to happen. But what I would like to do is kind of leave with some fire in my heart, you know, something like, okay, there is something that I can do. There is something that, you know, Ray can do, you can do, people listening can do. Like this stuff is not inevitable. We haven't already lost. Because if we've already lost, you know, what is the point of talking about this or doing anything? So, Chris, help us resist.
I mean, you asked the most pessimistic human alive to help you with that. But, you know, I do agree, right? Like that, you know, as I said, I think recognizing what the project is is important.
I think that's key.
In a lot of ways, the systems that we now largely understand to be AI, right? You know, I know that there are lots of things that don't fit to these categories, but chatbots and large language models, right? The project of these things is to consolidate power, to present, you know, an authoritative version of a truth that has not a lot of relationship to truth with a capital T. And I think within, you know, the other thing is to teach us to rely on these systems and not our friends and our community.
Right.
And in the case of things like wearables and things like that, to not trust ourselves as the reporters of, you know, how we feel, what we think, you know, whether we slept well at night, anything like that, that to understand that that is the project, right? Not, you know, whether it's like a good search engine or not, right? That matters, but it falls below sort of understanding what the overall project is. But if we can start to do that, I think we can understand a little bit more what it means
to resist, right? And that, you know, it, that takes all kinds of forms. You know, I am very skeptical of the, like, just don't buy it kind of thing.
Yeah. Right?
I think that's important. But, like, one of the things we've started to see is that these companies no longer look at us as consumers who accept or reject things, right? That sort of mode of power is not, you know, I'm very skeptical of what it has ever meant. That mode of power, that lever is increasingly smaller.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, and that's, you know, that's why it's being shoved into things. So that sort of, you know, like, try to buy a TV that's not connected to the internet, right? If you doubt my, doubt my assertion here, right? But I think that there are large and small things. I think a lot is going to come from worker power, right? Yeah, I mean, people like you, right? I think that some of that is going to look like political action. And I think some of that is going to come from communities who reject data centers in their areas, right?
Great point.
Yeah. And so I think that it is going to require all of those things and more, but it's certainly possible. But to reiterate, I think understanding what the project is a very important aspect of thinking about ways to resist and leverage our power.
I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Ray, I see you jumping up and down.
Well, no, I think that's a fantastic way to kind of like wrap up, because I think our project essentially is exactly that, you know, is to try and get to the heart of what the project is and strip away the hype and stuff like that. So I love that point, I think, and the point about things masquerading as a tool of knowledge when it's really a tool of power. I mean, I think those kind of things about like what the real truth is essentially to me is like where we should be putting our efforts. I think the other thing for me, and it's something I think resonates with you as well, Chris, is being creative and try to retain your own humanity as well on a very individual basis. One of the things that I had this experience recently with a good friend of mine who put some nonsense out on a Slack channel saying, I made this like concept of a story and ChatGPT wrote it for me. And then I asked it to make an image and it made this image. I was like, yeah, it's fine. The story's fine and the image is fine. Yeah. But I responded to him by saying, actually, I would like your story. And he says, oh, well, I wouldn't have thought of this. I wouldn't have thought of that. And I said, well, it doesn't matter. Whatever you would have thought of would have been better because it would have been yours.
Yeah.
It would have been your story. And if you made a drawing of that thing, it might have been terrible by comparison to what the DALL-E made, but it would have been yours. It would have been produced by a human. And I think for me, that is like critical to get people to retain their own agency and creativity.
You know what? I think this is so important. You know, I don't want to keep going over, but like, I think that this is like essential because, you know, and I refer back to this Columbia essay that the people who make these things, again, if you pay attention to what they say, part of what has been very consistent is the glee with which they talk about putting creatives out of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That, you know, art is over, right? You don't, you know, you can have your own, you can, you know, novelists like are not important anymore. Like all these things, right? That it's very clear that it's a profoundly anti-human movement.
Mm.
And that the things we have, if I read James Baldwin or, you know, Walter Mosley or June Jordan or Toni Morrison, right, that there is a thing that I'm not going to get into the whole like sort of magical like way that words connect us to other people over time and space, right? But I think it's important and it should not be misunderstood. So like when we say, could a chatbot write a poem, right? That's actually like not the right question.
Yeah.
Right. Who cares?
Right.
Who wants to read it? Right. I think is an important question. Like, what perspective does this connect us to? And the answer is none, right? It doesn't have a perspective.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And so, I think that's really important.
Yeah. This whole like glee about ending creative work has some real like Hitler failing out of art school vibes to me, but you know.
Right. Yeah.
One question I wanted to ask you, because I think this whole like understanding what the project really is, like that's so key. I'm just wondering, like, the researchers, the people building these things, what the fuck is going on there? Like, do they not understand the project? And if not, how can we get them to? Or is it just a case of when my paycheck relies on me not understanding what I'm doing, you know, I won't understand? Like, what? Help. Help me understand this.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so much to it. I mean, I think about for so long how data scientists and computer scientists kind of resisted unionization.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, they bought into that, the story they were being told that they are very special boys, you know, whose individual genius says that they would never need to worry about that. You know, there's a lot of them looking for jobs right now. I mean, and I don't say that with glee, right? Like, I don't, you know, I don't advocate that. Like, I'm not happy about that. But I think with a lot of these things, a lot of people do not understand themselves as part of a particular community, right? It's why I think I talk about surveillance so much, and, you know, why I even developed like the idea of luxury surveillance, that until people see themselves as part of something larger, that it's very easy to work on these systems without an understanding or without a caring who they might harm, right? But, like, I mean, I think ultimately a lot of these very anti-human, anti-consent technologies come for us all. I mean, they come for us in different ways and in different degrees.
Yeah.
They eventually come for us all. I think that's a thing people need to understand before we, you know, can have sort of a larger movement.
Just to loop back to the creativity and the humanity side, is that I think it was Cory Doctorow said that the fundamental of art and anything is communication.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah. I think as you say, Chris, it's like, well, what does this thing, this robot, what does it have to say? What does it have to communicate?
Yeah.
Nothing. It has nothing to say, nothing to communicate. Could it be used to find problems in an x-ray that a doctor couldn't see more reliably? I'm not sure. Well, I'm pretty sure it couldn't, but I know that certain technologies, certain well-trained models could do that. But these kind of technologies are inherently unreliable.
Right, the LLMs, yeah.
You know, and they even claim that that makes them more human.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like the ultimate joke, you know, is that our fallibility is mirrored in their fallibility.
Yeah, you see that a lot with the self-driving car.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Right. You know, so what I was trying to get at was, to your point, is that, yeah, let's stay clued into what the job is, but also let's stay talking to each other and communicating to each other and being part of something together, because it's all too easy. And we see this in the software world all the time, that people are essentially willing to build all of the necessary technology for the gas chambers before they get put into them.
Yeah.
That's my drop the mic moment. I'm sorry, I'm out.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Yeah, but we were supposed to end on a hopeful note, Ray.
Oh, yeah, shit. Okay.
Right, put that...
I thought you were going to do some ninja editing shit. Come on.
Yeah, I'm going to have to... Oh, Jesus, yeah. Do you have any closing thoughts, Chris, before we wrap up and let you get on with your day?
You know, I just... I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this stuff, you know, and I mean, what I would walk away from is, you know, like, I'm a writer, right? I'm working on a book, and I often, you know, send snippets of things to people. I mean, get back ideas and things like that, right? I'm working on this piece and, or part of a chapter, and the advent of electronic locks is sort of important to this piece I'm writing. And I found out this week, you know, through going back and forth with some friends and things like that, the first car to have them was in 1915, you know?
Wow.
Right? I'm thinking, like, I first saw them in the 70s, and I thought that's... But no, like, a car in 1915 had electronic locks, right? Central locking. And that this insight came from, like, a back and forth with friends, you know, me reading something and me sending it to someone else and me saying, hey, what do you think about that? And, you know, people claim that these systems can produce insights like that. And like, I really don't think so.
No.
But the other thing is, I think about the growth I had from like when I wrote the essay that first mentioned that to when I had this insight, and like how important and fun and like smarter I think I am like right here and now than I was last week, just from that little tidbit.
Hmm.
And so I think when people are talking about sort of, you know, instead of talking to a friend about this thing or having a friend read a piece or, you know, talking to your friends about your problems or whatever, like try this bot. But I think what they're trying to do is remove that element of growth. I think that's so important for us, right? That even that we have in conversations like this. And so that's why I'm so protective of these kinds of things and so intensely reject them, you know, from these systems, right? Is I think that there's a type of insight that is only going to come from these kinds of conversations.
Yeah, I love that point. Anything that kind of ends with, if you want to resist, just be more human.
Yeah.
That to me is inspiring.
It was an absolute pleasure, Chris. I mean, you know, I think your thinking is important to us. It's very aligned with the sort of things that we're thinking about. But as you say, every time you think about this stuff and you iterate over it, you have a kind of refinement. And this conversation, you know, was so wonderful to me because, you know, we heard you directly and, you know, in the moment thinking about this stuff and, you know, giving us real great insights. I think it was an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again for your time, and really look forward to reading your book when it comes out. And obviously, we'll keep reading everything you write. So thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you've given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!